The U.S. imposes fresh sanctions on Turkey. Is it the beginning of a tit-for-tat trade spat? Live from London, this is the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Victoria Craig. Good morning. Hours after the U.S. raised tariffs on Turkish steel to 50% from 25% and sanctioned Turkish ministers in response to the country's military action in Syria, the country's currency, the lira, rose as much as 1%. That's because investors had expected tougher action from the Trump administration. The BBC's Özge Özdemir explains how much of an impact the penalties will have on the Turkish economy.
The market reaction to these sanctions are limited because the markets were expecting more, because the Treasury Department of the U.S. has announced on the weekend that they can be imposing sanctions upon banking industry and also to some companies. So that's the reason the reaction is limited, and the Turkish lira actually has strengthened against dollar because of that.
But we have seen VW, a major car maker, postpone a $1.4 billion plan for a car plant in Turkey. Are we likely to see more companies follow suit?
That plant, that factory that was planned to be built, Turkish experts, economists were so excited with this development. But which other companies would be following suit? We are going to be waiting for it.
As you said, some U.S. lawmakers are calling for tougher action on Turkey. Will that pressure maybe force a potential tit-for-tat trade spat between the U.S. and Turkey now?
Turkey has already said that. Turkey said that if the U.S. will be imposing sanctions, we will be imposing the same sanctions, tit-for-tat. We will also be taking precautions against it.
A story we'll be following closely. The BBC's Özge Özdemir. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's do the numbers. Brexit optimism is sending the pan-European Stoxx 600 index up about 0.5% and the British pound strengthening slightly against the euro. That's after the EU's Brexit negotiator said reaching an agreement on the UK's departure is still possible. Meanwhile, US stock futures are slightly higher ahead of earnings results from JPMorgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, Wells Fargo, and Citigroup. A tourist advisory against visiting Indian-administered Kashmir has ended. Political leaders have been released from house arrest, and cell phone services have been restored to 4 million people. But how is the region's economy faring 2 months after India's government ended the state's 7 decades of autonomy? The BBC's Amir Pirzada is in Kashmir. He's only just got his phone service back yesterday.
Personally, it was exciting getting a first call from yesterday at 12 in the noon. That was exciting and was a great experience, and everyone was congratulating each other, saying, wow, we got a call. So from last around 3 months, which is 70 days, we were not able to speak to our friends, relatives, sources, nobody. We were not in touch with anyone.
So with service only partially restored, how are people communicating? How is business going about? How has all of this impacted the economy?
From last 70 days, all the business centers, commercial hubs, everything is suffering. Majority of them are suffering. Basically, Indian-administered Kashmir, it has 3 sources which contribute to Kashmir's economy. First and primary, which is major chunk, comes from horticulture, that's from apple trade. Other chunk comes from tourism. And the third one, which is minute, not that big, but is from handicraft. So all of them have been suffering. We talk about horticulture. Around half the population of Kashmir is dependent on horticulture, that's apple trade. People have not been able to get in touch with the dealers who are outside Kashmir, who are the buyers, basically actual buyers. And there was no transport, so people are not able to transport, ship the apples to outside rest of India. That was also because that was also one of the biggest hurdle. So as of now, we haven't seen any development or any prosperity coming to state. Maybe in future, government had some plans, but as of now, things are very scary.
The BBC's Amir Pirzada in Kashmir. Thank you.
Thank you.
More than 700 million people around the globe live in extreme poverty, according to the World Bank. One person trying to address the issue is Esther Duflo, who, alongside her husband Abhijit Banerjee and Michael Kramer, won the Nobel Prize in Economics. Ms. Duflo said the goal of their research is to make sure the fight against poverty is more effective and based on scientific evidence.
If you want to really make a dent in fighting poverty and the problems that go with it, you really have to kind of approach it problem by problem and try to put away your preconception and your intuition and instead bring in scientific and rigorous mindset, identify a problem, think about possible solutions to this problem, and then put them to the rigorous test, which we are doing with experiments. Poverty is not just about lack of income, it's also about poor education and bad health. In fact, some of these issues that the poor people and poor countries struggle with are also found in richer countries.
One of those issues is class sizes. And to identify possible solutions, Ms. Duflo and her team conducted one experiment in Kenya focused on student-teacher ratios.
One of the questions we were asking is whether kids would benefit from much smaller class sizes. There are 100 kids in one class in grade one. If we could halve the class, that would really help. So what we did is that we worked in about 200 schools in Kenya and obtained some money from the World Bank to hire an extra teacher for grade one. And there we got the surprising results. You go from 100 kids to 50 kids, and if everything else is as usual, it makes no difference. However, the schools that got tracked, everybody did better. Our feeling is because in the absence of tracking, the teachers only teach to the best student in the class. And the people who haven't quite gotten there yet understand absolutely nothing, so they get nothing out of the classes. And the new teachers were much, much better than the old teachers. So what they didn't have in experience, they compensated with much more energy and willingness to do their job well.
That's Nobel Prize-winning Professor Esther Duflo there. Finally, almost 1,200 chief executives left their jobs in the first 9 months of this year, according to recruitment firm Challenger Gray and Christmas. It's a 13% increase from a year ago, and many reasons for that outflow have been floated, everything from a looming recession in the U.S. to chief executives just wanting to spend more time with their families. In London, I'm Victoria Craig with the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.